For the week of October 10th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 74, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Orlando, Florida, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And on the west side of Manhattan in my Captain America uniform, wondering where everybody has gone, I'm Michael Giltz.
Kick ass.
I'm here for the Comic-Con. Is Comic-Con over already?
I guess
so. That's right. Your poor excuse for a Comic-Con on the East Coast.
Hey. As everybody I spoke to said, at least this comic convention is focused on comics, not stupid TV movies with all those stars to distract us.
Yeah, well, actually, I'll give you that. That's a good point.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. It's my first time going to any Comic-Con. I was here in New York Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I was a little overwhelmed. Friday was good. I couldn't get beyond the fact that people were in superhero costumes. That took me a while. It was actually kind of sexy by the end. That's kind of scary, too.
And, yes, it is.
But Saturday and Sunday was absolutely a madhouse. You could barely move. I mean, there were so many people. Everybody says it's been growing and growing. Clearly, it doesn't have the pull yet as far as movies and TV events. But it's getting bigger every year, and there's a lot of comic books there. So it was a lot of fun, I have to say.
Well, we should probably start off this week by mentioning that we didn't have a show last week because I was traveling and I was in Italy and had zero internet connection. And by zero, I mean I had an internet connection, but I think it was slower than dial-up. So we couldn't do the show last week, and we hope you didn't go through withdrawal. But we have a good show for you this week. And
no, we hope they did go through withdrawal.
Yeah, absolutely.
We hope they missed it. We apologize, and we hope you missed us because we missed you.
Yes, whatever Michael said. I I second that.
And next time, Sperling, when you're in Italy, bribe the right officials, and you'll get all the internet access you need.
I will say this. Maybe I just had bad luck, but boy, the internet connectivity in that country, I could not find a good internet connection.
Wow.
But this week, we're going to try and understand why it is everybody seems to be reporting on Academy screenings and why that's a new trend among entertainment blogs. And if you don't know what an Academy screening is, just stick around and we'll explain. We'll talk a little bit more about former NBC topper Jeff Zucker and what his future plans might be. And speaking of the future, we have word that a few manufacturers are working on 3D televisions that won't require glasses. In music news, Glee makes some news by surpassing one of the best-selling acts of all time when it comes to Billboard's Top 100 chart. Ann Thompson of IndieWire will join us a little later on during Inside Baseball to talk about some of the changes taking place not only at her own outlet, but across the entertainment media landscape. Of course, we'll review the week's top entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular lightning round. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie for the second weekend in a row was The Social Network, which fought off three new entries and a ton of pre-release buzz and hype that might have made the first weekend front-loaded. But no, it's getting really good word of mouth. It's gotten great reviews. And frankly, everybody I speak to wants to talk about it. So it's number one at $15.5 million. It's at $46 million total. If you're thinking of Oscar hopefulness, well, that's great because it's turning into a hit, but not such a big hit that people get tired of it right away. At number two is Life as We Know It, the Josh Duhamel and Katherine Heigl romantic comedy that opened decently to $14.6 million, though that's quite a bit lower than Katherine Heigl at her peak. At number three is Secretariat, the Disney film starring the always beautiful Diane Lane about the owner of one of the greatest horses of all time. That's at $12.6 million, which is about right for a family film, which is what Secretariat looks like. Number four is week three, of Legend of the Guardians, the Owls of Ga'Hoole, which is not really doing as well as Warner Brothers would have liked. That's at $40 million total. And number five was the last big new entry of the week, a horror film, The Return of Wes Craven, My Soul to Take, about a group of teenagers, one of whom might be the reincarnation of a serial killer. Nobody cared. It opened to $6.9 million. And number six is Ben Affleck's The Town, which is chugging along. That's at $73 million total. Number seven is Oliver Stone's Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, which is fading fast both here and overseas. It's at $43 million total in the U.S. and about $26 million overseas for a movie that costs $70 million to make. And number eight is the teen high school comedy Easy A, $48 million total. That's going to do even better on DVD. And number nine is Case 39, a minor horror film. And at number 10 is You Again, which is at $20 million total. I was at Comic-Con and the Yankees and at Broadway watching musicals. Did either of you see a movie this weekend?
I watched about 20 movies on the flight back from Italy to Los Angeles, and then another movie on the way from Los Angeles, which I was in for a whopping 12 hours, on my way to Orlando, where I'm attending Show East, which is a, I don't know what you'd call it, convention for movie theater owners and movie theater or movie distributors.
It's your Oscars.
It's not really, not really. No, I'm not going to go that far.
I saw Life as We Know It, and I saw The Social Network again.
Good job. So tell me, what was Life as We Know It like?
It is pure junk food. It's really enjoyable while you're watching it, and you completely forget about it, and it's probably not all that good for you. But let me tell you, Josh Duhamel has turned into a movie star. Somewhere along the line, along the way, he took acting lessons. He does such a good job in this movie. He is a movie star.
Yeah, he's a tall glass of water, and he got better and better on the TV show with James Caan as he was starring in it.
Las Vegas, yeah, but he was awful in the movie that he did with Kristen Bell, When in Rome.
Right.
And then he was even worse in the movie he did before that, Win a Date with Tad Hamilton. I mean, he was terrible.
Oh, that was
but
bad, yeah.
Katherine Heigl is so incredibly unlikable in this movie, and we're supposed to like her. So it's definitely not an acting choice. It's the actress herself. And you can tell how unlikable she is because the baby who plays the baby
Don't say that.
She is so comfortable with Josh Duhamel. You can see her. She's happy. But whenever Katherine Heigl is holding her, she looks like she's about to cry. And it's not something in the script.
Don't say even babies don't like Katherine Heigl.
I'm just telling you, it was distracting because every time Katherine Heigl was holding the baby looked upset. And whenever Josh Duhamel is holding the baby looks really happy. And that wasn't something in the script.
I'd be happy if Josh Duhamel were holding me too.
Kids got good taste.
What did you think of The Social Network on a second viewing?
I thought it was just as good.
Really? Because I want to see it again.
I didn't find that I lost anything. You know what I mean? Like I didn't discover anything new, but I enjoyed it just as much.
Why did you go a second time?
My sister wanted to see it, and all of her friends had already seen it. It's required reading at this point. You know, for anybody who works in the business.
Couldn't you just tell her what it was about through Facebook?
No, honestly, you guys, I think Aaron Sorkin's going to win an Academy Award for this. The writing in this movie, I think, is so crisp. It is so good that I think he'll be nominated, and I think he deserves to win.
Despite the fact that absolutely nobody talks the way his characters talk in that movie.
I don't have a problem with that.
Who wants people in real life to talk like they do in the movies? Of course, you want movies to be better than real life.
Well, now, you mentioned Academy Awards, Karen, and I found it very odd. I was kind of putting together stories for today's episode, and I was shocked to find, not shocked, that's a little overreaction, but I was taken aback, maybe, that Pete Hammond, who now went from the Los Angeles Times to Deadline Hollywood with Nikki Fink, and has joined Michael Fleming there as well, remember that name because we're going to be talking about Pete Hammond later, but he was the LA Times Oscar and awards guy, and now he's over at Deadline doing the same job. He wrote about an Academy screening, the official West Coast Academy screening of The Social Network. And I remember when Ain't It Cool News was writing about marketing screenings and they would have their little spies go and talk about audience reaction. And now Pete Hammond has little spies in the audience that are telling him how the Academy screenings are going. I mean, what has the world come to?
Well, that's very different because the movie has opened officially. So it's not like they're reporting on a screening that is a rough cut of a film. And basically, it's just you've got a lot of bloggers who are dedicated to covering the Oscar race, and they all need an edge. And over the last few years, we've seen more and more of them reporting about, you know, it doesn't matter what critics and audiences think. What really matters is what the 60- or 70-year-old Academy members think. And if you go to an Academy screening and see some cool movie that everybody loves that they don't get, you know, it's not going to play to Oscar voters. And so they go to Oscar screenings, and they report on how the movies are playing. Like The King's Speech, of course, plays great. And people were worried whether The Social Network might be a little too hip and young for them. But I believe he was reporting that people were really into it and quite liked it.
Well, yes. And, you know, it is, as a lot of people are saying, a front runner for Best Picture. However, there's some speculation that maybe because of the advanced age of some of these Academy voters, that maybe they won't get it. They won't necessarily understand it. But,
you know, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think that's more true of Emmy voters than it is of Academy voters, because the Academy has gone to some lengths to make sure that there are younger members of the Academy. And the Academy members that I know who are in their 50s and 60s are actually pretty young and pretty hip and pretty responsible as far as, you know, making sure that they watch everything.
No, I think you're right, but they've definitely gotten younger, but they're still true that the Academy tilts a little bit older. The idea that they don't even know what a cell phone is crazy, but But, you know, but there you are. But I wouldn't call The Social Network a front runner to win Best Picture. I'd say it's one of the movies that's in the mix and is going to, you know, get a nomination. That's what I would say. It's way too early.
Yeah.
I haven't seen, you know, I hate when people go, it's the front runner to win. I'm like, no, it isn't. We haven't even seen 5 or 10 more important movies.
It's just it's the first likely movie to be nominated, I think.
Well, that and Inception and Toy Story 3.
Inception. Inception probably was. Yeah.
Yeah. And a few others, too. Yeah.
And we should probably say that Academy screenings are screenings that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences holds for their members so that they can go and watch the movies in a giant movie theater in Beverly Hills. I think it holds 1,200 people. It's a beautiful movie theater. It's one of the best movie theaters I've been in the world. And they hold these official screenings toward the end of the year of films that are released throughout the year so that Academy voters can, I don't know, bone up on their...
Right. See the movie and not have to rub elbows with the rabble.
Yeah, the riffraff, the little people.
Like us.
Like us.
Me.
Wait, no, wait. I take that back. Like Karen.
I wonder, do they show trailers in front of the screenings?
No, they do not.
They do not. Because there was a great item that was also in DeadlineHollywood.com, Deadline.com, I should say, about two writers who had a pitch for a screenplay called Hollywood Nights, which I think Sperling wanted to talk about.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to talk about Tony Gilroy first, but why not? We can talk about – we were talking about Aaron Sorkin and how he might win an Academy Award for The Social Network. We can talk about this story in Deadline where two writers who made a trailer for their screenplay Hollywood Nights, and it's about what would happen if Elton John, Mick Jagger, and Patrick Stewart, all of whom have been knighted by the Queen of England, if they were transported back in time and had to save the Queen for real. And the writers' names are Kent and Dave, and that's all I know. I mean, and that's all that's actually in the trailer.
Here's what I think is interesting about that story. First of all, the fact that somehow somebody convinced, probably Kent and Dave or their agent, somehow convinced or paid Nikki Fink to run this. And then all of the comments underneath it, which about half of them pointed out the fact that there's actually been a script by two other people, or actually I think one of them actually was named Kent. Kent and somebody else who's
and
not
Joe.
Dave, somebody else. Yeah, that had this exact script that's been on the blacklist for years. And so part of me wondered, okay, who's got the good publicist? And part of me wondered, is this some kind of a hoax? And then the rest of me wondered, why are we even talking about this?
Well, and you just mentioned the blacklist there. We should kind of mention that the blacklist is not a blacklist, but it's a list of the best unproduced screenplays of each year that is put together by an executive at Universal.
It was on it for years before it was finally made. I honestly can't even understand why we're talking about this. I think the movie looks awful. I think the script looks like it was stolen. Why are we talking about this?
Okay, so then we should probably move on to another writer, not Aaron Sorkin, not Kent and Dave or whatever their names are.
Let's talk about Tony Gilroy because I find this really interesting.
Now, Tony Gilroy, everybody says, was robbed of an Academy Award 2 years ago when he wrote and directed Michael Clayton and was nominated for Best Screenplay. And then, of course, you know, the It Girl, Diablo Cody, won for Juno.
I don't think that counts as an outrage, but
it's not an outrage. It's an outrage, maybe to the person
who
just said it. To yeah, yeah, good point.
His mother.
Well, of course, he's written a lot of films. He wrote and directed one of Michael's favorite films, Duplicity.
And Michael Clayton was terrific too.
Yeah, and he also wrote the Bourne Identities, Supremacies. I don't know what the other one was called.
No, Legacy's the new one, right?
Yeah. Well,
yes.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Bourne Identity 4, Gilroy was hired to direct. Doug Liman directed the first film, The Bourne Identity. Paul Greengrass came in and helmed the other two, or as I like to call him, Man Who Hates Tripods. And yes, anybody who's seen those movies knows what I'm talking about. And they all starred Matt Damon. And Damon has said, that's it, I'm out. I'm not doing a fourth one.
No, that's not quite what Matt Damon said. Matt Damon said he would only do a fourth one if Paul Greengrass directed it. That, my guess, is for two reasons. One, because I think Paul Greengrass is a fantastic director. And two, because Matt Damon had such a bad time with Doug Liman on the first one.
Yeah.
So he's trying to cover himself because he doesn't want to do a movie like this with another incompetent director like Doug Liman.
Well, the last movie that Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon did together was Green Zone, and that didn't go so well. It was also for Universal. Universal Pictures.
Well, it didn't do well. The shoot might have been fine.
Right. And apparently they started putting the Bourne film together, the Bourne Identity 4, which
Born Legacy.
Yeah, it's tentatively titled Born Legacy. Turns out they started putting it together when Greengrass and Damon were off making Green Zone.
Well, yeah, but this film isn't going to include the Jason Bourne. I believe it's some spin-off character. That's my understanding.
I think it can be rewritten so that it doesn't include Jason Bourne. I don't think it has been rewritten yet.
Didn't he kill everyone? What spin-off character could possibly exist?
I don't read the books, so I don't know how the last one ended. The third one was the last one in the series, right?
Well, no, there's more written since Robert Ludlum died. I mean, the books were carried on by Eric Van Lustbader and other people. And Jason Bourne appears in those books, but my understanding was that there was going to be some other person spinoff, and that was how they were going to get around the fact that Matt Damon was sort of done with the series.
Right, but so let's be real. So they're probably going to go one of two ways. I mean, let's be real. You want Matt Damon in this movie, but if you can't get him, then it seems
Bourne.
Yeah, then it's fine.
Are they rebooting the Bourne Identity?
Exactly.
They can.
Apparently, Gilroy and Damon have no affection for one another because Damon and Greengrass changed some of the writing in one of the last Bourne films, I think the Bourne Supremacy, which Gilroy refused to see because of it.
Who's that according to?
According to an article I read that I don't have.
Did you like the source? Because I never heard that. But it just seems like, you know, the film ran its course, and Matt Damon most likely is just like, look, I've done the film. I had two great films with Greengrass. It's a full trilogy, you know.
I'm sure if you paid him a boatload of money, he'd show up to work.
I'm sure if you hired Greengrass, you would have a better chance of getting him to come to work.
Right, but I think they're both creatively realized that they've done the Bourne films, and it's time to move on. You know, smart actor would say, look, I made three of these. They made a ton of money and I love them, but I don't want to make 20 of them.
Well, maybe they can get Matt Dillon. Apparently he's hard up for cash because he's suing.
That is so not true.
That's not true either. Don't say that.
No, that is not true. I know, but it was a perfect segue into talking about how he's
a terrible, untrue segue.
It was a lie of a segue. Matt Dillon is not on the street corner begging for money.
It was a segue lie.
I'm going to pay him to beg for money just to prove me right.
Matt Dillon's production company is one of many production companies who are suing the, I don't know, financiers, primary producers, who are they suing exactly, of Crash for creative accounting and making sure that certain people didn't get paid as much as they should have.
Well, it says here the film grossed $98 million worldwide. Of course, it won the Oscar for Best Picture and spun off a TV series. Executive producer Bob Yari sued the Academy for denying him a producing credit and thus the chance to stand on stage if they won Best Oscar. And, of course, he lost. He did not get
Best
to stand
Oscar,
on stage.
Best movie, yeah.
Best picture, best, thank you, best, you know. Mm-hmm. And Thandi Newton's suing, and I don't know who they're suing. I guess
they're all suing Bob Yari, basically.
Yeah, well, he hasn't had good luck with this film.
Yeah, and you know what? If all these people are suing him, I'm going to have to say that they probably have a point.
Well, the point is that
everybody else won.
Know, right, people had the producers, Kathy Schulman and Tom Noonan, sued successfully, I believe.
And, yeah, they did.
Paul Haggis, Brendan Fraser, Bobby Maresco is a co-screenwriter. The point is, when you get a really small film and you get actors say, hey, let's all just do this for the art and the love of it, that's great. But you got to be careful because when you say, if there's some crazy back end, which will never happen, you know, people don't expect to see any points. They don't expect to see any money from points unless to make a really small movie that costs $8 million and grosses $100 million worldwide. At that point, they say, you know what? I actually should be making some money off of this.
Yeah, they're doing it for the love of it until your movie makes $100 million.
Right, exactly. And they're happy to do that. And they, you know, this was a movie that shouldn't necessarily have been expected to make that. So it might have made $20 million. Everybody would have been thrilled and nobody would have expected to make any profit on it as far as points. But, you know, when it has that much of an outsized success and then a lot of money on DVD and a spinoff TV series, all these actors and people say, excuse me, I know accounting is crazy in Hollywood, but this is a little much.
Speaking of spinoff TV series, which is my way of segueing into television news. Should we talk about television or just skip all of the 9 stories that somehow we've managed to highlight?
Well, it's been 2 weeks, so we've got a lot to cover.
Well, some of them kind of are paired up. The first one we have here is that the FCC is asking Comcast and NBC Universal for more information. And Broadcasting and Cable had this story, and they're reporting that this Comcast-NBCU merger still requires a little bit more input. And, of course, the FCC for those outside the country is the federal community.
Hang on. We've lost Michael Giltz.
Do you think this is going
to
happen?
I'm going to have to agree. Do I think it's going to happen? Who knows? Yeah, probably. It just seems to me like the FCC is doing its due diligence. I'm not sure how much more of a story is here.
Since when does the FCC do due diligence? I thought they just like approved every merger, whether it was good for the public
Bush
or not.
Bush is not in office anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not entirely true.
Well, they want to see all these agreements regarding carriage with competing MSOs their multi-system cable operators. They also want to see some information on rate changes. So basically, it's a whole bunch of anti-competitive information. Wow, is that the way you snore, Karen? That's no.
I actually don't snore.
Oh, okay, well,
I'll be
apparently
the
not.
Oh, yeah, like the judge of that.
That's very good. Well, meanwhile, Deadline is reporting that Steve Burke, who is one of the heads of Comcast, has begun taking over control of NBC Universal in place of Jeff Zucker, who he fired just last week.
And well, of course.
The deal isn't even done yet.
Well, yeah.
And Michael, you highlighted a story here about what will Jeff Zucker do next. The Hollywood Reporter is kind of prognosticating by interviewing a bunch of people. You want to explain who they talked to?
Yeah, well, I was contrasting the story with an earlier story they'd done. The Hollywood Reporter obviously is in flux. They're hiring a lot of people. They're revamping themselves. They're launching a weekly magazine to appeal to a broad audience rather than just the industry people. So they've got a lot of things going on, finding their way, figuring out what they want to do online versus in print and how they're approaching all these things. It's a lot of fun to see, exciting. They're hiring people, so we're all happy for them. I was struck by an earlier online article which said, you know, what is NBC going to do? Because NBC is just in the toilet. It's fourth place. It's a disaster in prime time. And that article was sort of just dashed off. It had no quotes from anyone. It was very lame. It had five suggestions for NBC, one of which was win Thursday night. Like, start winning Thursday night.
So for the Yankees, it's like win the World Series.
Right, yeah. You should really create some hit shows was basically the advice they gave for one of their points.
Oh,
they said, because you're at war on Thursday night. And I'm like, you're not at war. The war.
That make hit shows?
Yeah. I was like, what do you mean they should win Thursday night? They've lost it years ago. They've been in third or fourth place for quite a while now. So in contrast, here was a good story, I thought. This was what will Jeff Zucker do next? And in contrast to the earlier story, which is just sort of a bloggy, dashed off, no content thing, this had a lot of people. They quoted a lot of people, spoke to them at length. They spoke to Bill Carter from the New York Times. They spoke to an executive search firm. They spoke to former NBC head Warren Littlefield, who's been in the same position that Jeff Zucker's in, a career coach, David Brownstein, a top exec, Mike Medavoy, anonymous agents. So I really found it was a good example of what hopefully they'll be doing more of in the future.
Part of me wants to like slip my wrist because the guy's making like, but what's his golden parachute?
$7.8 million in salary and bonuses paid out over the next 2 years.
So about 15,
and the people are like, he really should take some time off, clear his head, think about what he wants to do. I'm like, F you. God, I wish I had that kind of an option.
On the downside, I should say the only reason I found the article was because I clicked on a link to a story about ABC's My Generation, and it took me to this story instead. So bad link, bad
Whoops.
Link.
Well, I know that 3D seems to be a hit these days at the movie theaters, at least most of the time. And of course, everybody's wondering, how is that going to translate into the home? I know, Karen, you hate this stuff. I did not highlight this story. This was a Michael Giltz special.
This was me. I think the one way 3D can work at the home is when you don't need glasses. That's what I hear from everyone. If I didn't have to wear glasses, I might be into it. And they're coming right away. It's not something in the works down the road. In Japan, at Christmas, they will be selling 3D televisions that don't need glasses. I think that's big news.
It just goes to show you, Japan gets everything cool first.
They do. It's a great market.
That's
true. It's a great competitive market, and they really work out all the things and then conquer the world. So it's that's true. They're going to have a 12-inch screen is going to be about $1,400. A 20-inch screen will be $2,900. Obviously, that will come down. You have to sit in certain locations in order to get the 3D effect. So you can't be in the other room and glance back in and see the show. But there are like 9 spots where they say it will work. Obviously, they're going to keep fine-tuning and improving that and getting bigger screens and lowering the prices. But you know, all bets are off if you don't need glasses. That will change things substantially in my mind as far as the viability of 3D in the home.
You know, it will change things in your mind, actually?
What?
When you actually see these televisions. Because
I've seen 3D. They have them in stores.
Yeah, no, what I mean is when you see these auto stereoscopic, which is what 3D without glasses is referred to as, you will find that the resolution is horrible. They call it 780p. It's not, maybe it is 780p, but the way they do auto stereoscopic on televisions without glasses right now is through a lenticular technology. So it's kind of like those postcards that kind of have two or three different images on them. That's the way they do it, which is why you need to be in certain angles. Having just come from the International Broadcasters Convention in Amsterdam, I can tell you, under no certain circumstances, this is a long way off.
It's not even close to ready for prime time.
It's not close to. No, and look at the screen sizes, 12 inches and 20 inches. When was the last time you bought a 12-inch television set?
For my car, I guess. Well, that's good to know.
Smaller than my computer.
Yes, precisely. So
that's good to know. So maybe 10 years off, but maybe it gives hope for people who think 3D with glasses is a disaster in the home. And there's also a delay in 3D video games. Nintendo has a handheld 3D game, which they've been promising. It's called the Nintendo, I think it's 3DS is what they nickname it. And it was supposed to come out for Christmas, and now it's delayed till March of 2011 because they just know the demand is going to be a ton. And it's basically a handheld video game that you can slide a little lever and play games in 2D or if it's available in 3D and make it even, you know, you can adjust the range of how excitingly 3D a video game is. And so that's going to be coming out, and that's early next year. And you don't need glasses for that either, obviously. But hopefully they work that out better than the Toshiba TV screens that Sperling saw.
You know what Nintendo's doing, and they created a lot of buzz at E3, the video game convention earlier this year, when they showed the what do they call this thing, the 3DS or something?
I think so.
D3. So yeah, I mean, and this is a perfect way to use this technology: a small screen where you have to stare at it in a certain way. I mean, it's going to be right in front of you, so you're always at the prime viewing angle. That is a great way to do auto stereoscopic. So
and you don't need the same high resolution. Because it's a video game.
Correct, yes.
Especially the handheld ones.
Yes, and it's small, so how much resolution do you really need?
Yeah, and the final big TV thing was Google TV. Google's trying to work into the TV world. Everybody wants to have that set-top box control and be your guide to television and combine, you know, internet, email, and television and DVR all in one space. They all want to be the portal for that. Google made a big announcement. It looks interesting. Some people like it, sort of, but they announced all their partners, and the partners that were missing were ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox.
But see, here's what I find interesting about that. You can still watch those shows elsewhere online. So if you have Google TV, you can still watch ABC, CBS, and what's the other one, Fox? You can still watch them just
all
via
big four.
Hulu or via CBS's website. I don't understand why.
Well, isn't this just
an
interlink? Isn't this like technology that they're going to embed in products the way they have Google software for Android phones?
Right. Sony is going to have it's going to be built into their new television sets, and Logitech is building a box that you can attach to an existing television. So if you don't have an internet-ready television, you'll be able to do so with this Logitech box. And there's no pricing on this stuff yet, but Forrester Research, which is a kind of a financial analyst firm and technology does some technology research. They expect 43 million internet connected televisions in the United States by 2015, and that's up from 2 million this year. And I just heard the COO, the chief operating officer of Paramount, say that worldwide by 2015 there will be 500 million internet ready internet connected televisions.
No way.
Yeah, but still I don't know, that may very well be the case. I have a feeling that internet connected TV is going to be one of those things that hits a tipping point and then just all of a sudden everybody has it. But I still am not quite certain what the big deal is that CBS, Fox, and ABC are not playing ball with Google TV. You could still find those shows elsewhere online. So why does that matter?
Well, because you want the people to partner with you to make your interface work and design things. A lot of these people like HBO and CNBC and Twitter and Netflix are designing their stuff to appear websites on Google TV in an optimal way.
I.e., so they're building apps. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, but if I have Google TV, I can still watch ABC shows by just going to Hulu.
Well, Google TV is just like your program guide. It's not – yeah, it doesn't stop you from watching any channels that are available on your cable.
Right.
You know, what's interesting is you say that people can go to Hulu or ABC, NBC, CBS through Google TV just and watch those programs right on online through their television sets. Fred Hunsberry, the COO of Paramount, was giving his presentation today at Show East. He, in six clicks, went and found Wall Street 2 or Wall Street Money Never Sleeps online and streamed it for the audience. Six clicks using Google. So
is he going to be fired?
Wait, legally?
By
legal? Well, no, it was illegal, and that's what he's talking. You know, his whole presentation was about the evolution of online piracy, and it was fascinating.
So he just taught everybody in that room how to find Wall Street Never Sleeps money.
Is he going to be
Money Never Sleeps for free?
You know what?
Is he going to be fired like Roger Friedman?
No, he's not. I mean, basically, you know, you would say he taught everybody in the room, but. You know, the statistics that he had were hundreds of millions of people are going to these sites anyway, so it's the cat's out of the bag. He went through Google and he pointed out that Google is launching its own TV technology, and so people will be able to do this on their television sets at home.
So what was his point?
No, his point was that we have to attack the sites and the pirates and the ISPs that allow them to be accessed, et cetera. One of the things Google may be offering its partners is to fight more aggressively the sources of piracy and to not allow them to appear high up on the search lists when people are looking for pirated material.
Yes.
If you guys were running if you guys were running Fox and ABC and CBS, would you play ball with Google TV?
I played ball with anyone, absolutely. Who's a major player who might be the entryway to the
to the
portal? Yeah.
I would too. I think it's interesting that when they're holding back, you know, I don't pretend to be any smarter than these guys. They must have a really good reason, but I'd play ball with Google. Anyway, okay, moving on.
Well, moving on. You know, unfortunately, we have a sad bit of news here. Stephen J. Cannell, the prolific TV writer and producer, died at the age of 69 last week, and he died from complications of melanoma, skin cancer, at the age of 69, as I just said. He was the creative force behind The Rockford Files, 21 Jump Street, The A-Team, Wise Guy, The Greatest American Hero, The Commish, Silk Stockings, Hunter, and I could keep going.
He had one of the greatest tags. At the end of one of his TV shows, it would be like, was it an animated him? No, it was real him.
He'd be typing furiously.
Yeah, and then he'd yank the piece of paper out of the typewriter, and then it got animated, and it just kind of floated and like turned up and turned into a C for Cannell.
Yes, he would throw it over his throw it over his shoulder. Yeah,
it was the perhaps the first famous production logo, and it's been parodied on The Simpsons and other shows. I remember it as a kid too, seeing it. I think on The Rockford Files and The Greatest American Hero, and it definitely stuck in your head.
Speaking of The Simpsons, did you guys see the Banksy version of the?
No.
Simpsons Beginning?
I tried to see it online, and it's already been yanked.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. I watched it earlier today. I confess I don't get it. And maybe it's just because – I mean, I know who Banksy is, and I know the significance of the beginning section of The Simpsons. But I watched it. I'm like, okay. So he's sending up the fact that the Simpsons is, you know, basically just a bunch of stuff that they manufacture now, and it's done in a sweatshop. And all my friends are sending me this link. I'm like, okay, so what? And then Fox aired it. That is probably the biggest story. Fox aired it.
Well, and we should say for our listeners that Banksy is a graffiti artist who made a documentary or was part of the making of a documentary this year called Exit Through the Gift Shop. He keeps his identity a complete secret, so nobody knows who he is.
And the film Exit Through the Gift Shop is a lot of fun. Whether it's real or fake, I don't know. I assume it's real, but you never know, and you should check it out.
You know what was real? Glee toppling the Beatles record for most hit singles on the Billboard 100 chart. And
yes.
that is the segue to music news.
Well, tell us.
Well, they have six new entries on this week's Hot 100, thanks to their Britney Spears-themed episode. And they
I hated. Oh, God.
I did, too.
I hated
that episode. A weak one.
Well, this show is so on fire. I mean, they toppled the Beatles' four-decades-old record for most singles placed on the chart. They had, I guess, 71, and it's only Elvis, who had 108 singles, and James Brown, who has 91, have scored more. I'm just shocked at how many people want to guest star or direct an episode of this series. Bruce Springsteen will guest star. Baz Luhrmann wants to direct an episode. Baz Luhrmann, the filmmaker behind Moulin Rouge and Strictly Ballroom. Lance Bass of NSYNC has been trying to get his band's music on the show. Everybody wants a piece of this show.
It's because it celebrates artists and theater geeks, of which a lot of artists today were exactly that in high school.
Well,
and of course, it's the cool new show, and everybody has to be a part of it, blah, blah, blah. But I have to tell you, I think this season so far is weak.
Well, I liked the last episode that dealt with faith.
Yeah, I did too.
That was, I liked that I they
too.
Kept Kurt an atheist. I was worried they were going to break
out. Oh, my God.
That
was, my sister and I were watching it. We were saying this. We were saying the same thing. We were like, oh, please let them not change Kurt at the end. And I was so glad he remained an atheist,
It was a shame the gay boy had to be the atheist, but fair enough. It was a reasonable...
It makes sense, though. It would make sense that if anyone was the atheist, it would be him. But yeah.
Here's a question for you. What are you talking about? I've got no idea. I don't watch the show.
Well, we're talking about this week's episode of Glee in which Kurt's father, the gay character, the only openly gay character at the moment, his father...
Not the father, Kurt.
His father's in the hospital, and they start talking about faith and doing songs that are inspired by faith, everything from Simon.
Because they want to pray for him, and Kurt basically says, please don't, I don't believe in God.
Can I just say that was not an invitation to actually tell me what you were talking about?
the one thing I didn't like about the reporting of Glee toppling this record is a couple things. I shouldn't say one, but a number of things. One, it's not really a band. It's a TV show spinning off a bunch of unaffiliated songs. It's still a huge credit. It's still notable, but it's not the same as Rolling Stones releasing. It's, five different artists associated with the show, and they're not all the same person. It's not even like the Monkees. It's very notable. Number two is that these songs are popping in and popping out very quickly. They're not top 10 hits. They don't have anywhere near the top 10 hits like the Beatles or Elvis or James Brown or a lot of other artists. So they're appearing on the Hot 100, and it's a reflection of the technology and the fact that you can click on them, buy a song, and sales are so low that if you buy 5,000 copies of a single, it's going to hit the Hot 100. So a very small minority of people is able to get a song ranked at number 87 or 94 or 62 and turn it into a Hot 100 hit. I could get a Hot 100 hit, frankly, if we just organized our podcast viewers and had them all buy the single on the same day.
So you're saying the news isn't a big deal?
No, it is a big deal. I know it's a segue, but it is a big deal. It's notable. It's a statistic. It's valid. It's true. But you got to put it in context of these are not
flawed.
Right. They're not big Hot 100 singles, and it's a reflection as much of technology and the accessibility of singles as it is of how hot and successful Glee is.
Well, I just failed to segue us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is one I wrote about this week on Celluloid Junkie. There's a little
shameless
plug.
That's awesome.
Plans to show part one of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows in 3D have been scrapped by Warner Brothers. Why? Some special effects are still being finished. Actually, that's not true. It's the conversion work is still being finished this month, and so there wasn't enough time to convert the shots into 3D. And while Warner Brothers was happy with doing a half-assed job on Clash of the Titans and suckering people into forking over premium dollars for poor work, they didn't want to mess with their crown jewel, Harry Potter. Some estimate the film will lose some $50 million in revenue because of this decision. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think this is a big deal because it's showing that studios are finally taking this kind of seriously. That if you don't have, your 3D is not ready, you can't half-ass it.
I agree completely with Karen. That's absolutely true, that they shouldn't half-ass it anymore, especially with a big movie. I disagree that it would have cost them $50 million in revenue, because I think if it had been a 30% higher ticket price, people would have been that much less likely to go a second and a third time to the movie. And I had read, I think it was Hollywood Reporter, that said that the special effects were still being finished, and therefore there wasn't enough time to finish the conversion of the special effects into 3D, that they were just finishing up the special effects like last month. And so therefore the conversion time, there wasn't enough time to do the conversion. So I think it's all chicken and egg, but there you go.
Well, I know that for the 3D vendors here at Show East, it is a big deal because a lot of theaters and theater owners were stocking up on digital cinema equipment and 3D equipment to show Harry Potter because, of course, that was going to be the big blockbuster film, and it still will be in 2D, and they will release part two of The Deathly Hallows in 3D as planned in 2011. Our next story, Michael, I think you'll appreciate, Justin Bieber wants to record a duet with you on his next album to support gay marriage. What do you
what?
Think? Yeah, actually.
What?
It's a true story. Yeah, he was thinking of maybe a cover of Total Eclipse of the Heart. Or,
Once upon a time, I was falling in love.
Best song
now
ever.
I'm only falling
apart. Wait.
Totally ready.
Yeah, okay, well, here's the thing. You've just been punked. The truth is that the MTV show Punked is being revived. once the domain of Ashton Kutcher, it's now Justin Bieber. You gotta watch out for. Is this a big
can't
deal?
Can't make this stuff up.
You can't make it up. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal as far as the spread into the Justin Bieber empire. You know, you got to be worried about spreading yourself too thin. He's got a movie. He's got a TV show. He's got this, but it makes sense. It's logical. He was funny on Funny or Die, the website, and I think it's a good fit.
You know, I'm panicked to say that I think this is a big whoop. I mean, this is a big deal, but I guess I do. And I just, I wish it wasn't.
Should Superman prepare for glory? It's official that Zack Snyder, the director of the Sparta epic... Is it Sparta? I guess it is Sparta. The Sparta Epic 300, and of course The Watchmen, by the way, will be helming the next Superman movie with Christopher Nolan as producer. Apparently, delivering the flop animated Owl film didn't bother Warner Brothers. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, is he the director of that weirdly titled, creepily looking Owl movie that's out right now?
The Guardians of Ga'Hoole.
He did quite well with 300, and Watchmen got mixed reviews. I think it's an interesting choice. Big deal.
It's a big deal because it's a big property. I don't know if I'm excited about the choice, but, you know, good luck to him.
Moving on, ebooks that cost more than hardcovers? It's already happening. Blockbuster author Ken Follett has a new book that costs $19.99 in its ebook edition and $19.39 on sale in the hardcover edition at Amazon.
Huh? What?
A James Patterson co-authored book, Don't Blink, is $14.99 in ebook form and $14 in hardcover. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because ebooks are a new industry. It's still got a lot of room to grow before it's accepted, and they're just messing around with it and don't know what to do, and they're being idiots because there's no way ebooks should cost more than hardcovers. They should, frankly, be a fair amount less like they have been. And it's just the idiocy of the publisher's industry not knowing what to do.
Karen.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal because I agree with you, Michael, that they don't know what they're doing, but they're so stupid because if you do the iTunes model, make it affordable or cheap and make it easy to buy, people will buy more.
Yep.
Hello.
Just as George Michael is released from prison after 4 weeks, director John McTiernan is going there. He's been sentenced to 1 year in federal prison for lying to the FBI about the wiretapping and racketeering scandal connected to Anthony Pelicano. And gosh, if we had to go into what that whole story is about, we'd be here forever. Let's hope his cellmates...
Yeah, Google it.
Yeah, Anthony Pelicano. We'll put it in the show notes. Trust me, it's an interesting read. Let's hope his cellmates are big fans of Die Hard, which the filmmaker made. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a big deal, but wouldn't it have been a bigger deal if it had happened right when the story was like really hot? I mean, what was that, 2 years ago?
We're sorry the wheels of Justin move too slowly for you.
Yeah, they really do.
It's a big deal. When, you know, you can make a lot of mistakes in your life, but when you've got your lawyers and you're sitting down and talking to the FBI, don't lie.
Is silver the new black? Anderson Cooper certainly hopes so. He's launching a new Dynamite talk show in the fall of 2011 in the hopes of filling the void left by imminent departure of The Oprah Winfrey Show. But don't worry, news junkies. The show is being distributed by CNN's parent company, Time Warner, and everyone is eager to reassure viewers that Cooper will be part of CNN primetime for many years to come. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, he's launching a new daytime talk show. I don't know how Dynamite it will be yet because we haven't seen it. But it's a big deal because they want to keep him in the CNN and Time Warner family. I think his persona could work very well in daytime. I think it could work very well. He's been a lot on Regis and Kathy Lee as a substitute host. He's on Ellen a lot. And, you know, he's not a huge powerhouse in prime time, frankly. But he might somehow – he's got a lot of visibility and he might somehow work a lot better in daytime. So I'll be interested to see how it pans out.
See, I'm not sure I agree with that because – his interests do not transfer well to daytime. I mean, he likes to, you know, talk about Bosnia and Afghanistan and everything like that. I mean, does that really transfer to, God, how sexist am I? Does that really transfer to Housewives? Do they care?
Well, it's not going
to
be a hard news show. Well, I mean, it's going
to
be a daytime
talk
show.
I find that odd, too, because he seems to be really interested in hard news. I mean, why would he want to do fluff?
Have you seen him on Regis and Kathy Lee?
Yeah, no, he's very charming. He's very charming, yeah. But I.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what he is. That's what he'll be. He's not going to try to do Nightline during daytime. I think he's going to a little more substance than Regis and Kathy Lee, obviously. But I think it's, you know, he knows it's a different venue and needs different issues.
Pop star and six-time Grammy winner Toni Braxton has filed for bankruptcy and says she owes anywhere from $10 million to $50 million. I mean, how much money do you have to spend to not know whether it's $10 million or $50 anyway? This is the second time she's had to declare bankruptcy. During her career, Braxton sold 20 million albums in the U.S. alone and had 12 top 40 hits. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, God, big whoop. Toni Braxton has filed for bankruptcy about as many times as Lindsay Lohan has been in rehab. It's somewhere I'm done with it.
I think it's a big deal because it just shows you, like, no matter how much money you make, if you're an idiot or don't have the white people around you, you're gonna end up, you know, bankrupt and alone.
This is like the third time that she's filed.
It's her second time. It's the second time, but you've got to watch what you're signing. You know, trust no one and get a good.
She should be put in jail. I mean, how stupid can you be? Okay, go on.
She hasn't broken the law. She hasn't broken the law. She's just gone bankrupt.
She should be put in a mental hospital for being stupid then. I mean, come on.
Yes, you can send your emails to Karen at showbiz. Wonder Woman is coming back to TV and David E. Kelly has got her. Yep, the man behind Ally McBeal, Boston Legal, and The Practice is going to create a new TV series around the Amazonian superhero who turned into a feminist icon and even graced the first cover of Gloria Steinem's Ms. Magazine. That was a mouthful. Our prediction...
Ms. Magazine.
Ms. That's Magazine. The whole point.
Our prediction? The Justice League is switching to co-ed bathrooms. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think he's a good pick for her, and because he is very... female friendly, and I hope it's a period setting, though. I think Wonder Woman works best in World War II. I don't like her in today.
I found actually Ally McBeal to be incredibly sexist, so I don't know if I would call him female friendly. I say that this is a big deal only if it actually happens. Otherwise, it's just man gets job.
And with that brings us to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the news stories that Hollywood might care about. Joining us this week for Inside Baseball is Ann Thompson of IndieWire, and I would tell you what Ann Thompson's position was there, but I think maybe we should actually, you know what? I know what we can do. I'm going to quote Brian Brooks of IndieWire. In his story, Ann Thompson named IndieWire Editor-at-Large. Leading film journalist Ann Thompson is taking on a greater role at IndieWire as the company enters a period of transition. The news is one of two important developments at IndieWire this week. While Thompson will maintain her popular blog at IndieWire, thank God, her new title, IndieWire...
I will maintain it.
Yes. Her new title, and thank you for joining us, your new title, IndieWire Editor-at-Large, formally recognizes a role that you have, according to Brian Brooks, unofficially served for some time at a moment when IndieWire prepares to add additional new leadership soon. And I guess... Eugene Hernandez, we mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago, he's leaving for the Lincoln Center Film Society, where he is heading up digital strategy. I still don't really know what that means, but I'm sure it sounds very important. And you're headed to be an editor at large. I've never understood what an editor at large does.
It's one of those great titles where if they haven't figured out what the job is yet, they can call you that. And
excellent.
You know, it means it's as vague as you choose it to be. It means I'm not the editor in chief. It means I'm staying in LA. I'm still continuing with the blog, and I'm putting in a little more time in helping them find the editor in chief and steer the course and all that. So I'm happy to do that.
You're gonna help them find the editor in chief?
You betcha.
Is it going to be like one of those Dick Cheney? Yeah, like the way he looked. Like, you know, I've looked everywhere, and I can only the best vice presidential candidate is me.
That's always a possibility. But better it should be done that way, where they come back to me begging. You know,
I'm surprised they weren't begging already. I mean,
they're not because A, they're all based in New York, and B, they don't want me to stop doing the blog either. So it's the blog is sort of dictating a lot of things in a way because I've invested.
You wouldn't be able to do both?
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. No, I think that would be very hard. That's a very demanding job.
I mean, have you ever looked at how many posts per day Anne has on her blog, Karen? It's like 928 posts per day. It's
Absolutely. Yeah, I have help. I do have help, but it's I'm into it, you know. It's I'm happy. I'm happy with the whole new scenario. I'm not happy that Eugene was leaving, by the way. That was not something I was happy about, because everything was going very smoothly and going very well. I'm happy for him, and he's happy. But we will all find the right person and move on to the new and improved and fabulous IndieWire. The potential is great, I think, to redefine it and build on the good structure that's there already.
Well, I have to say that I'm still speechless that Eugene is leaving. I mean, as long as I've known him, he's been the editor of IndieWire, 15
I
years.
know, very singularly identified with IndieWire. So, and thus the first initial response was sort of like, whoa, you know. Also, because it was going well, the momentum was good, everything was going really well, and that's one of the reasons I think he felt free to go. And the people that have worked with him for many years are still there, Brian Brooks and Peter Knecht and Eric Cohn, the critic. And then Todd McCarthy going to The Hollywood Reporter. In that case, I'm really happy for Todd, because he was someone who had long, you know, for like 30 years, worked at a place where he had a rhythm and he knew what he was doing and he was writing reviews and covering festivals, and I think he's returning to that rhythm and that comfort zone of being supported by a large organization, and that being that sort of lone wolf blogger out of his house didn't really suit him, you know. It was tough for him.
Well, that was the other piece of big news mentioned by Brian Brooks, is that Todd McCarthy, who was, as you mentioned, a film critic for 31 years with Variety, was laid off earlier this year, moved to IndieWire, where he had his blog, and now he's moving over to The Hollywood Reporter, which is undergoing some changes of its own. It's really, Janice Min is heading the,
Moving fast.
she is moving fast. I mean, it's no
Wow.
longer going to be a daily. It's going to be a Was it, is it a
A
weekly?
weekly,
Yes.
a very big, glossy, you know, fancy weekly.
And, you know, I've talked to a few people over there, and I think their heads are spinning, frankly.
Yeah, no, they're like doubling down. I mean, they're doubling the staff. They brought in Degan Penner and you know, Kim Masters, and she's an editor at large, I might add.
You're in good
You know,
company.
editors at large get to weigh in, you know. They get to say, they get to be, they get to, you know, hey, I think we should do this. I think we should do that. And then they don't have to carry the responsibility. No, I'm kidding a little, but it's sort of true.
You know, I think there's some frustration over there at The Hollywood Reporter, from what I'm hearing, from existing staff, that new
well, they
staff is.
just, well, Elizabeth Guider's out as of today, the editor there. And then they also announced that Andrew Wallenstein is also out. So those are
Really?
two of the senior people there.
I think the existing staff people are having their heads spinning because they haven't found exactly where they're headed yet, and they're all uncertain and not where they don't know what their role will be. But I'm intrigued by you mentioning about the refocusing of IndieWire and all the potential there. Do you have any ideas and the conversations you're having about what ways you'd like to take IndieWire and where do you think it can grow and expand?
Well, I think that if there were to be some additional resources applied to it, it's been a very it's been one of those things that's grown organically over 15 years, and you know, Eugene founded it, and it's been done on a very small, you know, nimble sort of scale, but it's also grown, and it's one of those classic cases of an organization that now that Eugene is leaving, you can look at it and you can reorganize it and restructure it and give people different jobs and sort of, you know, make it a little bit more, you know, just, I never went in and tinkered because Eugene was in charge, but there are certainly ways that you could imagine, you know, bringing in other writers and voices and making it even more consumer oriented. I love the idea of IndieWire being a smart movie site. You know, that this is an area of the internet that is less developed than all the you know, the big movie fan sites, you know, the slash films of the world. They're smart in their own way as well. But the idea that this could be that you could really make a brand and a niche out of this kind of content, it really appeals to me. And it's all there. It's just a question of, you know, moving forward with it in league with whoever the new editor in chief turns out to be.
it's sort of the role that Premier Magazine had for a while, where it wasn't about gossip and it wasn't about, you know, breaking deals. It was about smart, intelligent coverage of movies for people who love them.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And of course, having been at Premier, I miss Premier. But that said, you know, Premier was an expensive, glossy consumer magazine. And what's great about the internet, I look at these other sites that are still going for print. Even Nikki Fink, even Deadline is going for print now. They're going to do 5 special editions aimed at getting, guess what? Oscar advertising.
Yeah, wasn't that interesting?
I mean, Nikki started out on Oscar night, like, you know, 4 years ago, you know, dissing the Oscars. She's been complaining about how horrible the Oscars are for years. And now she's sucking up for the Oscar ads, just like everybody else.
Well, is being the editor-in-chief something that you would want to do, or would you have to move to New York? And that's something that you may not be all that comfortable with?
I'm really waiting to see what happens. You know, there's some really great candidates. Rick Allen, the CEO of Snag Films, is going to be interviewing people and has started that process. And I feel really good being his partner and you know, talking to Eugene and Brian and you know, working with them. I feel very comfortable with it. And we'll see who comes in. We'll see what happens.
Hold on, I'm just checking my email to see. No, he hasn't emailed me yet. Okay. I'm joking, of course.
Sperling, you seem very interested in this subject.
No, not.
I have to say, a lot. It's one of the gratifying things about all this is that a lot of really cool people have you know, thrown their hats in the ring. So there's a lot of great talent out there, and it involves having a real passion for the independents and knowing that community and loving film and having a journalistic background and, you know, real chops as a journalist, and also having an internet awareness, knowing how to function on the internet. Having all three of those things is not something that many people actually have.
Well, now let's talk about that for a second. And really what I'm referring to is you've mentioned that in a piece that you wrote called Hiring Brand Stars in one of your posts this week. And you've mentioned there's a lot of movement between, especially in the entertainment media, but I believe you mentioned Fareed Zakaria going from, Newsweek to Time.
Correct.
And the tons of entertainment journalists have moved from the LA Times to Deadline.
Well, you've got a lot of movement. And basically what's going on is that the person who's built a following, who has, you know, the columnist, the blogger, the person who has built a following is more valuable now than ever as a magnet for attention and you know, the friends and followers model on the internet. I have all my Twitter followers. I have all my friends on Facebook. These are, you know, a lot of people read me on Twitter and Facebook. That's where they read me. They don't go to the site and look for me. They catch me in these other ways.
Well, I know that a lot of the people that I've spoken with at some of the trades, specifically the Hollywood Reporter, are very upset that people are being brought in at twice their salary. I mean, they are stars, effectively, and the existing staff is grumbling a bit. Now, who knows what that means? The existing staff, of course, is used to covering a trade, not
celebrity. Well, what
celebrity.
Happened there at the Hollywood, because I was there and I watched the whole thing happen, was that it was always the second string sort of Avis to Variety's Hertz, and it was always a little leaner, a little meaner. In other words, Kirk Honeycutt wasn't getting the salary at the Hollywood Reporter that Todd McCarthy was getting at Variety. But on some level, you know, I always thought that the lean, mean approach was a better predictor of survival than what Variety was experiencing, which was being overloaded and fat and having to cut back. It's very difficult to get used to living at a certain scale and functioning at a certain level and then have to cut it back and bring it back down. The Hollywood Reporter did do that. And so I find it interesting that they are now in the position of having been sort of tightening their belts and you know, squeezing their pennies all this time. And now there's this enormous influx of cash. But it's a very short-term play. Now they're going to really spend a lot of money to get this weekly going. I guess my question would be, what happens if it doesn't work?
Well, right. And I think that's...
Goodbye, Hollywood Reporter.
Right. It's a big, risky
move.
Well,
they're doing really well online. That's the other... I mean, they're really successful online. And the traffic is going very well, even better than Nikki's traffic.
Do you think that's partially due, obviously, to the firewall at Variety? I mean, because I
Absolutely.
Used to go to Variety first. Now I
Absolutely.
Now I
Yeah, no, that's very much the case. And it's and if you look at the charts, you can see where that firewall came in. But it's also the way that I think Min has a real gift for presenting news and sizzle and selling stories and knowing what stories to chase down. And she's very aggressive and she's got the whole place sort of running after, you know, the stuff that's going to play. You know, she's got very good instincts for that. I think it will still function as a trade, but I think there's a whole lot more going on around that.
Well, and I guess Pete Hammond went to Deadline, and Mike Fleming. Pete Hammond, we kind of mentioned, was Oscar guy and at the LA Times, and now he's Oscar guy over at Deadline. There's so many. I mean, where is all this money coming from?
Well, Deadline is owned by Jay Penske
NMC.
and mailed it. Yeah, exactly. And they have, he paid a lot for Nikki and he paid a lot for Deadline and from what I gather, they're doing well enough so that the schedule of additional hires is going more rapidly than they even anticipated. But going after this aggressively after Oscar advertising with special editions and everything, that I never expected this definitively online outlet to go that way. And it just fascinates me.
It's dumb is what it is.
Have you been courted by some of these groups, whether it's The Wrap or Variety or The Hollywood Reporter?
There has been some courting, and part of what happened to me was that I was, you know, when that happens, you look at what your options are and you decide which way you want to go. And I decided I really was more excited about growing IndieWire, which I truly believe in and think is going to make it in the long haul and continue to grow the blog on IndieWire. And it's sort of like IndieWire and I are parents of this blog, you know, we're partners in this, and it's got deep roots, and it's not so easy to just move a blog. You can do it, but it's not easy.
And you've done it before.
I don't like doing it.
Yeah.
I don't like moving it. You have to build up all the readers and the followers and the I don't know how to explain it. It's difficult. It's unwieldy. And I'm happy to keep pushing in the same direction that I'm going in right now. Even if it's a relatively small niche site, it's on the positive forward trajectory, and I believe in it, and I think we can make it work even more.
Well, we should mention the blog can be found on IndieWire.com, and or you can just type ThompsonOnHollywood.com into your web browser, and you will be taken right to Anne's blog, or you can follow her on Twitter. AK Stanwyck is her username. And Anne, I certainly look forward to seeing where IndieWire goes, and congratulations on, it's I guess a new gig, but...
It is. No, definitely. It's definitely more work, and I'm enjoying it. But thank you.
Well,
thank you for your attention and support.
I guess I can speak for all of us. Our pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
So we know that if next year IndieWire launches a quarterly magazine that gets distributed at Starbucks, we can hold our feet to the fire and say, hey, what's going on here?
No. I mean, look, hey, Anne is always a pro.
It's a really dumb thing that Deadline Hollywood is doing. A quarterly, you know, a couple, five issues.
So weird, right?
Stupid.
Well, you know, somebody thought we did a dumb thing. In fact, in our listener email this week, which is not going to be email this week, you can leave comments on our blog, showbizsandbox.com, our website. And the comments to episode number 73, our previous episode, we had, I guess it's an anonymous commenter, although his username is, or his, the name he typed in is Lulud with three Ds. It could be a her too, I should say.
Anyway.
Anyway. He or she writes, I have enjoyed your program and found your information insightful and interesting. Content that you cannot get from any other podcast. At least that I have found. I would pay this person to purchase ads in trade publications for us. Now, here's Anonymous goes on to say, had a problem with this episode, though. How can you call TV shows quote-unquote horrible after seeing a 30-second promo? Michael Giltz calling the event quote-unquote horrible and Karen ripping the shows without watching them is absurd. I really thought all of you quote-unquote journalists lost credibility.
I never pretended to be a journalist. Lula.
Well, thank you for writing. There might be a little confusion here because we do get advanced copies of some of the shows. So we had seen some of them. I'm not sure which one in particular, but I'd gotten all the CBS shows and some of those. And some of our reactions were based on, watching just trailers and commercials. But we were trying to say it looks terrible. We weren't saying we know the show is bad, but based on all the reviews and the trailers that we've seen, we're reacting to that, not to how the show is actually. But I know I've sampled all, virtually every show, every new fall show. And there isn't a lot of good news shows out there, especially the dramas. The event in particular, I think, is badly done. There's no tension in that show at all, and it's fading fast. So my prediction was right, but it was not based on, it wasn't a review of the show. It was a response to the selling of it. So I hope we didn't mislead you too much. But we also had seen a bunch of pilots and things like that. So
I am not going to pretend to be a journalist, but I am an avid TV watcher and have been for years. And you can tell. Just from promos and then from reading reviews and just from your own knowledge of TV. I know a lot of people who know a lot of people who tell me everything. You can usually tell. And so far, I think we are spot on in terms of what's going to be canceled.
Absolutely. But we did try and phrase it in the sense of reacting to the ads and the stuff, not to the show itself if we hadn't seen it. If we misled you, we apologize. But now I have seen the event and it's not good.
Well, I can't remember which show we didn't see, but there was one that was premiering October 21st, which there was no way we could see. So we were just, and we mentioned that. And we said this is just a best guess based on promos and ads.
It was the American Family one, the No Ordinary Family, I believe.
Yeah. And so we knew we didn't see that. But, I'd have to go back and listen to it. But, if that is the case, then hopefully we at least disclose that. But if you want to email us, you can do so. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave comments on the website, showbizsandbox.com. And you can even leave us a voicemail if you'd like. Call us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. You'll also find ways to subscribe to the podcast. You can subscribe in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or your favorite RSS reader. I guess I should also say that the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or at Comic-Con. He's also on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen is on Twitter with some hard-to-say username, Karen_Woodward.
How is that hard to say?
It's not.
Anyway, she also has a website, KarenWoodwardOnline.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, and I'm on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, when I will finally be back in Los Angeles, play nice.